Well, you knew that you were going to get blessed today. And, you know, whenever I hear Alex sing, I'm reminded of something. You see a lot of these modern musicians, even Christian musicians, and they've got dancers behind them on the stage, and they've got fireworks going off and these laser lights, you know. And I think if you've got the voice and the talent, you just don't need all that mess, you see. Thank you, Alex. And you do. Thank you. I'm reading from 2 Samuel 18, beginning with verse 24. While David was sitting between the inner and outer gates, the watchman went up to the roof of the gateway by the wall. As he looked out, he saw a man running alone. The watchman called out to the king and reported it. The king said, "If he is alone, he must have good news." And the man came closer and closer. Then the watchman saw another man running and called down to the gatekeeper, "Look, another man running alone." The king said, "He must be bringing good news too." The watchman said, "It seems to me that the first runs like Ahimaaz, son of Zadok." "He's a good man," the king said. "He comes with good news." Then Ahimaaz called out to the king, "All is well." He bowed down before the king with his face to the ground and said, "Praise be to the Lord your God. He has delivered up the men who lifted their hands against my lord and king." The king answered, "Is the young man Absalom safe?" Ahimaaz answered, "I saw great confusion just as Joab was about to send the king's servant and me, your servant, but I don't know what it was." The king said, "Stand aside and wait here." So he stepped aside and stood there. Then the Cushite arrived and said, "My lord the king, hear the good news. The Lord has delivered you today from all those who rose up against you." The king asked the Cushite, "Is the young man Absalom safe?" The Cushite replied, "May the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise up to harm you be like that young man." The king was shaken. He went up to the room over the gateway and wept. And as he went, he said, "Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son." Calvin Coolidge was the vice president under Warren G. Harding. He became president in 1923 when Harding died suddenly. Coolidge was then elected president in his own right in 1924. In 1928, he could have run for president again, but he declined. He indicated that the presidency takes a heavy toll on those who hold the office. And if he had stood for another term, he would have been in Washington more than 10 years, which in Cooley's opinion was too much for any man. But some students of history think that his reason for not seeking another term ran much deeper than that. For in his memoirs, Coolidge talked about the tragic, untimely death of his youngest son, Calvin Jr., at 16 years of age from a blood infection. And Coolidge stated then, "When my son died, it took all the glory out of the presidency." Think of that. A broken-hearted father President of the United States, but he said there was no glory in it. Because my heart is broken with deep, deep sorrow over the loss of my son. It must have been that way for David. He was the king of Israel. People bowed in his presence. Armies marched at his command. But there was no glory in it. Because Absalom, his son, was dead. Absalom was a gifted and handsome young man. He had charisma. He had appeal. And he had long flowing hair of which he was very proud, as Absalom was a charmer. He had won the hearts of the people of Israel, and they believed that in him they had a God-sent man who would lead them further onward when David stepped down from the throne. But the truth of the matter is, Absalom was a selfish and a self-centered young man. He cared for no one but himself. His goal in life was to get all that he could, any way he could. And in time, he rebelled against his father David, and he tried to take the kingdom by force. And in the battle that followed, the army of David, led by Joab, attacked and routed the army of Absalom. And as Absalom fled from the battlefield on a mule, his long locks of hair blowing in the wind became entangled in the thick branches of an oak tree, leaving him hanging helplessly in midair. And when Joab upon him, and in violation of King David's orders, he kills Absalom. And upon learning of the death of his son, David is shaken to the core of his being, and he breaks out in unrestrained grief, crying over and over again, "Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would I have died in your place? Oh, Absalom, my son, my son." One commentator has suggested that the death of Absalom represents David's greatest failure. That while he may have been a huge success in the eyes of the world, he was a colossal failure at home. And that may be true, but David would not be the first or the last person, the last father of whom that could be said. And I'll leave it to others whether or not it's true in the case of Absalom and David. But on this Father's Day, I want to talk to you not about failure, but about success as fathers. Not about losing, but about gaining your sons and your daughters. Now, do not misunderstand me. I'm not saying that the choice is either success in the world or success at home, that it's either one or the other. Not at all. What I'm asking is this: what is it that we can do as fathers to be successful in the home, in the lives of our children? What is it that makes for a successful father? That is, that enables you to be that positive, nurturing, godly presence in the home, in the life of your children that God wants you to be. And I submit to you that a successful father will love his children, That doesn't mean indulgence. That's how David loved his son. You can have anything you want. You don't have to earn it or be responsible for it or take care of it. You just have to want it, and it's yours. Some fathers love that way, with material goals, with material things, but it always falls short of the real thing. And as we saw in the life of Absalom, it can lead to disaster. A successful father will love his children. He will love them enough to discipline them. Understand, however, that the word discipline comes from the word disciple. Same root, same word, same idea. A disciple is a learner. It involves teaching, learning, disciple. Being a disciple is more than corrective punishment for wrongdoing. Discipline is guiding. It is directing. It is setting rules and limits. It is teaching a child that choices have consequences. It is teaching them how to live and how to get along with others in this world. And I would suggest to parents everywhere that if we are going to disciple our children, if we are going to teach them and guide them, then physical punishment should not be our first response. When they make a mistake, or they disobey us. Now, I know you, have you ever talked to someone, and as they told you about their childhood, they talked in such glorious terms when they got whipped when they were young, you know? It wasn't glorious for me. It was fear followed by pain, you see. Truth is, when we spank or whip a child, so very often it is our anger that drives it. Our authority is threatened by something the child said or did, and we react with physical punishment. It's quick, it's easy, and it doesn't involve a whole lot of time and effort. Talking, relating, listening, guiding, teaching. Now, I'm not suggesting that if you spank your child or if you have spanked your child, you do not love them. Not at all, but I am suggesting that that should not be our go-to method for discipline. That we ought to take a little more time to find out what's going on in the life of the child, to discipline out of love and not anger. A successful father will love his children. He will love them enough to nurture them in the faith, and he will do so as he lives out his faith before his children. And it will not be a faith that one puts on just for Sunday show, but it will be a faith that is real and visible throughout the week in the world and in the home. Fathers, we must understand that the reality and the depth and the truth of our faith will be revealed by the way that we live and act. And if we live and act in a way that reflects a pagan culture, then our children will get the message that there's not a whole lot of difference between being a Christian and not being one. So why bother? We must set the example for them. We must model for them what it means to know Christ, to be his follower. One little boy was asked why he believed in God, and he said, well, I guess it just runs in the family. Hope it runs in yours. Samuel Shoemaker, the famous Episcopal preacher, was asked how he came to believe in God, and he explained, Daddy didn't have to tell me about God. He believed in Him, and I caught it. I hope it's catching in your home. And I submit to you that a successful father will love his children. He will love them enough to build them up, to encourage them. As I said last Sunday, love doesn't criticize, love doesn't condemn, it doesn't look for the faults and the failures, love doesn't pull people down. It lifts people up. Love believes the best, and it looks for the best, and it affirms the best in others. And if that's going to be present anywhere, it should certainly be present in the home, in our relationship with our children. In his men's seminar, David Simmons, a former cornerback for the Dallas Cowboys, tells about his childhood home. His father, a military man, was extremely demanding, rarely saying a kind word, always pushing Dave with harsh criticism to do better. Dave had a father who had decided that he would never permit his son to feel any satisfaction about his accomplishments, reminding him there were always new goals ahead. Get this, when David was a little boy, his dad gave him a bicycle unassembled and then commanded him to put it together by himself. And Dave struggled to the point of tears with the difficult instructions and all of those parts laying around. Finally, his father said, I knew you couldn't do it. Then he assembled it for himself. For his son. When Dave played football in high school, his father was unrelenting in his criticism in the backyard of his home after every game. His dad would go over every play and point out Dave's errors. Dave said, most boys got butterflies in their stomach before the games. I got them afterwards. Facing my father, he said, was more stressful than facing any opposing team. By the time he entered college, Dave hated his father and his harsh discipline so much that he chose to play football at the University of Georgia. Why? Because it was the farthest school away that had offered him a scholarship. And after college, he became a second-round pick of the St. Louis Cardinals. That year, by the way, Joe Namath became a first-round pick. But when he was chosen in the second round, Dave was excited, and he called his father to tell him the news. You know what his father said? How does it feel to be second? Despite the hateful feelings he had for his dad, Dave began to build a bridge. Dave had come to know Christ in college, and he said that it was God's love that made him turn to his father, that enabled him to build a relationship with him before his father died. And I'm glad he was able to do that. But what a tragedy. Always feeling that you do not quite measure up, that there's something about the way that you are that is not enough. No matter what you do, no matter what you achieve. I don't know who wrote this, but it speaks truth to fathers for children everywhere. The greatest need your child has is to be assured of his or her personal worth. Every day our children confront forces that call into question their value and worth. Parents must be determined to counter the negative, critical, derogatory forces of society with strong doses of affirmation. by what we say, by what we do, by the affection we show, by the time we spend with them. We need to reassure our children that they are something special. Every child needs to know that he is worth something, not because of what he does, not because of how he acts, not because of his good grades, but simply because he is a unique individual created and gifted by God. It is our responsibility as parents to communicate that message to our children. Are you doing that? Communicating that, if you are, you're well on your way, I think, to being a successful parent. One thing more, a successful father will love his children. He will love them enough to do all that he can to be there for them as long as he can. Does that mean to be involved in their lives, spending time together, doing things together, talking, listening? Yes, all of that. But it means more than that. Gail Sheehy, in her book, Understanding Men's Passages, asks the question, what is the greatest gift you can give your children? Money, stock, a piece of the business, the promise of a legacy, all these are nice things to pass on to children, but not necessary. The best act of love you can give your children is to take the trouble to stay healthy and alive as long as you possibly can. Did you hear that? The best act of love you can give your children is to take the trouble to stay healthy and alive as long as you possibly can. Sheehy understood that too many fathers today are not taking the trouble, are not making the effort to stay healthy for as long as they can. They develop lifestyles, they acquire habits that in the end will cut their lives short. I remember a number of years ago, one of my sons and I were looking at some family pictures, and he picked up one of my father and said, I wish I could have known him. And I replied, I do too. You would have liked him, and he would surely have enjoyed you and your brother. And when I said that, I felt this wave of regret and sorrow come over me, and I thought, I wish he could have been there for them, but also for me. For there have been those times over the years when I would have liked to have gone to him and said, Dad, what do you think about this? Or what do you think I ought to do about that? But he died at 61 years of age when I was a sophomore in college. He had been a heavy smoker most of his life. He developed lung cancer. They said they got it all, but a year later he had a stroke from a brain tumor, and he died a few months later. Now, fathers, I'm not passing judgment on you this morning. I'm really not. But what is it in your life that has the potential to cut your life short? Anything at all? And if you won't turn it loose for your own sake, then do it for your children or for your grandchildren. It would be one of the greatest expressions of your love for them that you could ever give them. As Richard Cromie, a Presbyterian minister, said one Sunday to fathers, the only place where no one else can take your place is in the home. There are a multitude of other areas where you are important, even some where you could be essential, but only in your own home are you absolutely, replaceable. Indeed. Fathers, my prayer for you on this Father's Day is that you will do all that you can for as long as you can to be that positive, nurturing, godly presence in the home, in the life of your children, the kind of father that God wants you to be. And may God bless you and make you a blessing to them. Our hymn of invitation this morning is 606, I Gave My Life for Thee. I invite you to come this morning to receive Christ, to unite with His church, to recommit your life to Him as we stand and as we sing. You come.